history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, and you might never know what these brave Americans did unless you take the time to ask and then listen. And we're really going to illustrate that point today about big or small, because one vet we'll hear from lives in a metropolis that's a worldwide tourist destination, while the other has spent almost his entire life in a tiny town of just a few hundred. It's Father's Day weekend, of course, and in thinking about that, I realize that just about every weekend is Father's Day weekend on Hometown Heroes. If you don't get to hear your own dad or granddad on the show, you'll probably notice some similarities. And if you're fortunate enough to still have your dad around, maybe you pick up some ideas for some questions to ask him before it's too late. If you have lost that veteran in your life, perhaps the stories you hear will help you understand and bring into focus some of the conversations you never got to have. Anyway, in honor of Father's Day, we're going to hear from two different dads, and one of them you've already met if you listened to our last episode. We weren't able to fit in all of Mel Pliner's story last time, so we're going to catch the rest today. He's a native of Brooklyn, spent much of his post-war life in New Mexico, and now lives in Las Vegas with his daughter Carol, who we're also going to hear from today. Mel was a glider pilot during World War II. You can pick up the podcast from last time at hometownheroesradio.com, but we left off with the story of his final mission, the one that earned him the Purple Heart. He had already safely landed powerless planes in the Normandy invasion, in the invasion of southern France, and in Holland. This time, it was late March 1945, and Operation Varsity served as the last airborne deployment of the war in Europe. Also the largest ever airborne operation conducted on one day in a single target area, and the objective was the Rhine River.
Okay, we get ready to approach the Rhine River, drop down to 500. As we cross the river, I couldn't see the Weitzel, but before we took off, I was assigned a bazooka, and my co-pilot had a vest, three rockets in front, three rockets behind for the bazooka.
Right.
We were going to land close to a main intersection highway where we were supposed to join other troops to set up a defense to keep any resupplies from getting to the troops
right
in the front line.
Cutting their supply line.
Cross the Rhine, drop down, green light, red light, and I cut loose. And here's a big field, I don't know how many acres, big power lines with the high towers across the field, and gliders. Some of them hit the wires. So I figured, well, okay, I cut loose, and I'm heading for that, and I got a place where there's room for me to land my glider. I'm 200 feet high, and I'm holding the wheel like this, and some krauts, a bird shooter. Now, you know, most of the krauts were aiming at the pilot's compartment, and it was going to the tail section. This guy's a bird shooter. You know how you lead birds?
Yeah.
He was a bird shooter. I'm sitting like that, and he gets me right through the arm between the radius and the other.
Still have a scar
see
there?
See that?
Uh-huh.
That's where it came out.
Oh.
I said, take over, I'm hit.
So guys, this is your co-pilot who's never done this before.
He froze.
Can't function.
I pull up the spoiler and held it up with my left foot, and I landed it with my left hand and my right foot.
Because your right hand, you can't do anything
my
with.
My right hand hit. Fell down.
It's useless.
Into shock.
So you're landing this glider one-handed.
One-handed, 1 foot. Of course, I was only about 200 feet high. When I did that, evidently, I took and wiped out the gear on my right side. Just came right off. Because over there, the fields, about every 15 furrows, was a deep one to carry any moisture off the field instead of washing the grass off over to a ravine, a little ravine over there. Came to stop with the left wheel in the ravine and my right wing about a foot or two above the ground. By that time, all the troops had gotten out, and my co-pilot came to life, and he got out. I had on a flak vest. Now, a flak vest,
yeah,
it's got two snaps on each shoulder.
Right.
And it's got a belt around the waist with snaps. Supposed to be able to give it one good jerk and it's supposed to fall off.
Right.
Well, with my arm in shock, I'm pulling with my left hand, and it didn't come off. And I got scared, because with that thing on, you don't move very well.
It's
heavy. I gave
it
a second pull, and it came off, and I got out and got underneath.
Spurt.
This wound in your arm is spraying blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I get out to get out my first aid kit.
Because you're all alone. Everybody else is left.
Got out, put a bandage. I put it around here to stop the bleeding.
Uh-huh. You had to give yourself first aid.
Yeah. About 30, 40 minutes, my co-pilot is lying on there. And this guy, he wants to get up and run. I says, hell, you wouldn't run 15, 20 feet and they'd shoot you. Because there was still a lot of rifle fire. But it wasn't too long after our troops started to take over and the rifle fire started to just about quiet down. Shortly after that, a squad of American troops was crossing the field. I said, now's the time to get up and get in the middle of it. And we started yelling and screaming. And about 13 troops turned around with their rifles. American troops, hey, guy! Showed them the American flag on our shoulder. And we got in the middle of them. We got down to the ravine there, and there were other glider pilots there, troops. And there was a first aid guy. Mm-hmm. He saw I had this. He's, what happened to you? I said, I got one through the arm. He said, let me take a look. Took a look at it, put some sulfur, whatever it was, wrapped it, gave me a sling. He said, how does it feel? I said, hurts like hell. He says, here's a morphine syringe. Stick it in your arm. And he says, it'll keep you from hurting, slow you down. I says, I don't want it. If I got to move out, I want to be able to move out, which we did. I started to head back towards the Rhine River. And in so doing, I'm walking up the ravine, and I come across a house. And right in front of the house is a German doctor with two troops standing there watching them. And he's got a steamer trunk with all kinds of medications and operating tools. Could have performed major surgery there. And he's working on a paratrooper. The paratrooper's got his foot up on the back of a chair with his middle toe missing. Now, whether he shot it off or what, probably.
To get himself out of the line of fire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doctor's sewing it up, and he's got a cigar in his mouth and a .45 on his foot. He says, Doc, he says, if you hurt me, I'm going to blow your brains out. Doctor doesn't understand a word of English.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, sewed him up. Gave him a couple of pairs of crutches, and off he went. Called me over, looked, took that off. He went over there, and he got a big stick with something on it, stuck it in there. And I thought he was going to just, I was just dying, just wrap it, which he did. Made my way over to the shores of the Rhine River, where there was a first aid station, and there was a nurse in there. What happened to you, Lieutenant? I said, I got one in the arm. Took it off, look at it. More powder. By then, the bleeding was starting to slow down. It was bleeding a little bit, but it wasn't a spurt.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened, it went through the radiation ulna, and it didn't break any bones, but it hit the nerve to the thumb. You see the difference in the size?
Ah, okay.
Hit the nerve to the thumb.
Uh-huh.
She looked at it like that. By that time, it was starting to get dark. She said, take a towel there and get out there and find a place to lie down, get some sleep, and tomorrow we'll get you out of here across the river. So I take a blanket. By now, it's dark. A couple of guys out there. Pardon me. So I lay the blanket down. It's dark, and I lie down in that thing, and I bring it over me. And it feels like there's a 2x4 right underneath my back. By that time, she had given me a shot, and I fell asleep. I got up the next morning to see what the hell was under my back. Well, you know how mud slides up between dual wheels on a truck and dries up? Hell, I could have ooched for 40 miles and never got away from it. But anyway, I got up, gave it a towel back. By that time, they had some ducks. You know what a duck is?
Yeah.
Come across back and forth. So I got in the front seat of the duck, and they had some stretcher guys. They put in the duck, and across the river we went to a real first aid station where they had some doctors, but they didn't have any x-ray machines. So when the doctor looked at mine, he figured, well, it must have hit one of the bones.
He figured to get hit there with their bones so tightly worked there, it had to break something.
So he put it in a cast.
Uh-huh.
So here I am in a cast. Well, By that time, there was a little airstrip there. They were flying troops out of there. And he said, what hospital do you want to go to, in Paris or London? I says, London. So I was flown, and when I got to the hospital, they put me in a ward for bone fractures, stuff like that. And I was in a ward all by myself. I was there for 30 days.
Yeah.
During which time, the war in Europe was over. I figured I'll stay in London. And I had some English money, and after my money ran out and I couldn't withdraw any more money, I had to get on an airplane and fly over to Paris, where I called the base. They sent the Jeep out. The Jeep took me back to the air base where we were stationed, A-55. Place was deserted. Everybody was gone. Well, wasn't too long after that. Troops started to come back when their money ran out. And we were told to get ready, that we were going to be transported by train to Brussels, where we were going to get a ship to take us back to the States. And when we got there, I was assigned some ship. I don't remember the name of it, but it was a cargo ship, one of the ships that they had built to bring goods over to England, you know. In the holds, the forward hold and the aft hold, they had built racks with beds in them, cots. And I don't know how many they could put in the forward and aft, but when we got on board the ship, I was assigned one of the holds with these cots in it. And so I climbed down the ladder, got into that thing where my B4 bag and a duffel bag that I had some stuff in. And after we left port, I got back up and I went up to the cruise compartment and I talked to the steward. And I said, did you know my father, David Pliner, Sunrise Steamship Laundry? He says, yeah, I knew him. Well, I'm his son. I'm one of the troops down in the hold. He says, bring your gear up here and we'll put you in one of the cruise quarters. And I went into one of the cruise quarters. And I don't know how long the trip across the ocean was, but I went to the slop chest, got a pair of jeans and a shirt, and I was one of the crew for the duration of the trip. Had a nice place to eat, with the crew 3 meals a day. We were about a couple of hours out of New York City when we were coming into the harbor, and I figured, well, I better get back down there. So I changed back into my uniform. I got back there and said, where the hell have you been? I said, none of your business.
Never heard that story before, have you? It's something new every time. And we're not quite done with Mel. I want you to hear about his experience 65 years after D-Day, when he got to return to Normandy, and also about his most recent mission with Honor Flight Southern Nevada to Washington, D.C. His daughter Carol was his guardian on that trip, and we're going to hear from her as well. And then we'll meet another World War II veteran from a tiny little pit stop in northern New Mexico. Maybe Father's Day is an opportunity to explore the military service of your own dad or grandpa. Don't miss that opportunity, and don't miss the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Father's Day weekend with a couple World War II veterans today. I think the record among the 400-plus episodes of this show is 14 kids, and I'm looking forward to seeing that wounded Marine and the youngest of his 14 children in this week ahead in Sacramento at a special ceremony at the California State Capitol. We're going to hear from a father of eight from New Mexico in just a little bit. But for now, back to Mel Pliner of Las Vegas, Nevada, who told us about his missions as a glider pilot during World War II. After the war, he ended up in New Mexico, where he worked for Sandia Laboratories for many years. He'll never stop enjoying his talent for woodworking, and his storytelling skills are pretty solid, too.
So I read that you got to be at Normandy for the 65th anniversary?
Yes.
What was that like?
That was fantastic. Okay, the guy that wrote the book,
right?
Philippe Esvelin.
Forgotten Wings is the book, yeah. And you're on the cover of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He and I got to be quite good friends. Well, let me back up. After the war, the little town of Lamoy is where his parents lived. After he was born and as he grew up and got to be, I don't know what age, his parents told him about the gliders that came in and landed and so forth. And he became interested, and as he grew up into a young man, he became interested in the glider program and pursued it. He became active in the World War II Glider Pilots Association. He got a membership. And he attended all of our reunions.
Because it was the gliders that started the liberation process of his town.
And he got to talk to more glider pilots and get stories from them, just like my story.
Right.
That's part of the book.
Right.
And we got to be such good friends. I gave him all my Class A uniform. I gave him my ID badge. I gave him my A2 jacket. I gave him everything because I didn't think my kids would be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He took my picture, and it's on the front of the magazine book.
And that was the gateway to you going to Normandy?
Well, yes. We kept in touch. He made arrangements. We flew into Paris, and he picked us up, took us down to St. Mary Glise, and I was the only glider pilot there. And when people saw me in my outfit, "Oh, we want to take your picture. Oh, would you sign your autograph?" Free entrance to any of the museums, and they had a CG-4A, and they had a horse, a glider there, and all kinds of trucks and stuff like that. There. Yeah.
And the President of the United States and the President of France and probably a whole bunch of other big
ones. I got to shake hands with Barack Obama.
Did that make you feel like what you and all those other guys did meant something? Accomplish something?
Well, you know, I never felt myself as a hero. I felt I was trained to do a job, and that's what I did. I look at it this way. The reason that I survive is two things, my training and the man upstairs. I felt confident that, you know, once we took off, I could find a field I could land, which I did.
Even if it was a vineyard that took the bottom off your glider. What about this honor flight? I mean, that's your most recent adventure. You're almost 95 years old.
That was an interesting trip of a lifetime. It was. I can't say how much I enjoyed that or the people, well, the woman that was in charge and the people that we traveled with. And when we came back from the honor flight, there were, I don't know, thousands of people lining the exit. Holding the hands out, shake your hands.
How'd that make you feel?
Oh, that tall. That tall.
At the World War II Memorial, where they have that big wall of gold stars, and you know what it represents.
Yeah.
406,000. And you had a couple chances where that could have been you.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you think about when you were looking at that next to a daughter who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive?
That's right. Well, you know, again, I think to myself, if it hadn't been for training and men upset, I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
I think about that.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of your stories. I never know which way you're going to go, but it was entertaining.
It was a job that I was trained to do, and that's what I did.
And what more could we ask, really? That's Mel Pliner. And in honor of Father's Day, why not hear a few thoughts from the youngest of his three children, Carol?
When did you realize the adventures your dad had in the war?
I think the first time was when he was coming to Las Vegas for one of their reunions.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I didn't really understand. I didn't know the depth or the intensity or the... I really didn't know what he had done. I didn't know that he had been a glider pilot. I didn't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm. So you've been on quite a journey of enlightenment about his life.
Yes, I have.
At what point did it hit you that, man,
he's a hero?
And I wouldn't be here if he didn't survive some crazy stuff.
Exactly. Yes. I'm very, very cognizant of that fact. Unfortunately, I missed out on my childhood with him because they did split when I was only 8. But now I'm making up time for that. And he's definitely my hero. But I got to tell you, he can make or fix anything. And he is so safety conscious. I mean, all these years he's got a full woodworking and a full metalworking shop. Mm-hmm. He's got all 10 digits. I'm like, that is, you know, because I've seen a lot of men who accidentally hacked their fingers off, and but not him. He's very safety conscious, very good common sense. Just, I mean, he's pretty amazing.
What part of his story gets you the most or amazes you the most with regard to the war and the missions he flew?
Yeah. The first one is the fact that those planes didn't have much control except for the steering and the, you know, the altitude, which you could, I guess you could go up, but mainly you were going to go down.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, the landing conditions weren't always the best. They left
the
a lot to be desired, right. You know, you didn't have a smooth runway with lights and somebody telling you which way to go and whatever. But yeah, that and the fact that he did take a bullet and still managed to land that glider the way he did. It's like, that's just amazing to me.
And like I said, if he didn't, you wouldn't be here.
That's correct.
And you got to go on the honor flight with him.
Yes, I went as his guardian. And
I bet you had your hands full as his guardian.
Well, I'm his guardian all the time with him when he's with me, but yeah. No, because I know how he likes things, and, you know, I always try to anticipate what he's going to need or want.
What was the highlight of the trip for you?
Well, it scared me a little bit, but we had police escort everywhere we went, and they were stopping traffic and taking us through red lights and, you know, telling people to move over because people see a flashing light behind them. They don't necessarily know what the right thing to do. And so I was like, oh, God, please don't cause an accident just because of these vets are on this bus, you know.
Right.
But that was pretty awesome. That was impressive that they treat them like the true heroes that they are. And the other thing was, when we came back, my friend Nina had told me about, you know, oh, when they get back, there's this huge welcome thing. And but I mean, we must have been at the airport for about an hour and a half after we landed, just, you know, everybody thanking him and all the, they had signs. I've got a bulletin board out that I made up. They got mail call on the way back, and everybody got an envelope with cards and whatnot. So they did get their heroes welcome home, even if it was a few years after the fact. But that was very moving. That was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
He's amazing. He's definitely my hero.
And as we celebrate Father's Day, what father wouldn't want to hear those words? Thanks to Carol Eastberg and her dad, Mel Pliner, not to mention Belinda Morse with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, she connected me to that father-daughter duo. You'll see their smiling faces at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you'll also find some photos of Martin Martinez of Velarde, New Mexico. If you ever find yourself on the road between Santa Fe and Taos, you're going to have to stop in the tiny hamlet of Velarde. Only a few hundred people live there, but thousands stop through there at Michael's Mini Mart in Velarde, featuring Your Favorites by Alice. That's the official name for a big menu of pretty amazing New Mexican food. It's even earned rave reviews as part of New Mexico's Green Chili Cheeseburger Trail. But Alice would have never been born if her father didn't make it home from World War II. And you'll find him right behind that Mini Mart. You can't miss his trailer because it's the one with the flourishing garden of peppers and watermelon and whatever else is in season. And it's also the one marked with a flagpole secured in concrete and lit up so the stars and stripes and the U.S. Air Force flag can fly proudly day or night. I got to meet 3 generations of the Martinez family there, and it was so evident how revered Martin Martinez is and how special a Father's Day he's going to have this year. He was born in the nearby logging camp of La Madera, but moved to Velarde at the age of 5. His childhood jobs included threshing wheat on horseback. His love of horses has never faded. He rode with the Rio Arriba County Sheriff's Posse until he was pushing 80, and he proudly wears a custom silver belt buckle preserving the brand his horses once displayed. Martin lost his father when he was just 16, and a year later he signed up for the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was launching camps all over New Mexico. Before long, his culinary skills had turned a few heads.
I took over the kitchen. Captain came there one day, Martin, you had to take over because I knew everything already, what going on there, how to I make my own menus, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you were just a teenager. But this was a pretty big project. And if folks go there today, if they go to the Bandelier National Monument, they can see some of the buildings that those CCC workers were constructing.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, that lodge there would actually be used to house workers for the Manhattan Project, which a few years later would help bring an end to World War II.
Yeah.
So little did you know that you were contributing to that with your work there. Well, at Bandelier.
When we got there, there was nothing there.
You were in the CCCs for nearly 2 years working on that. Did you have any idea that war was coming?
No, because I didn't know anything about war until Arthur McCarthy started pulling some kids from there for his army. 50 kids went volunteered to join. I figured that it was going to be a war then.
So you're talking about the folks from New Mexico who ended up in the Coast Artillery, and a lot of them ended up on the Bataan Death March.
Yeah.
Right. But did you hear about that at the time? Were you thinking about it?
No, I don't think so, but I guess these guys want to get something different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that volunteered, and I heard they were with Anthony McCarthy up in Philippine Island somewhere.
Yeah, you know. Bataan and Corregidor. There were more Americans from New Mexico on the Bataan Death March than any other state.
Yeah.
There are some great monuments to that here in the Land of Enchantment. But for you, you get done with the CCCs, and then a few months later, Pearl Harbor happens. How did you find out about that? Where were you when you heard that the Japanese had attacked Hawaii?
I think I was still home, December the 7th. And I came and told my mom, they bombed Pearl Harbor. I heard it around 10 o'clock at night on the radio. And then later on, Roosevelt declared war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they declared war with Germany, you know, at that time. So there was that drafting. And I went over, I says, Mr. Luna, I want to register too. He says, Martin, you're not old enough. I got a job for you here in the farm. She said, no. I said, no, I don't want to work here. I want to go, I said.
So you could have had a deferment for agricultural reasons because the food supply needs people to grow things that they were growing. And he was saying, you don't need to go anywhere. Stay here on the farm and help me out.
Yeah, but I want to go, you know.
Why did you want to go? Why was that so important?
The idea that I just want to get out of here, you know, and see after my mother and kids, you know, my sisters. So I finally, he says, okay, if you want to go, okay. And they send me to Fort Bliss, Texas. From Fort Bliss, Texas, they sent me to a new camp in Camp Carson, Colorado, you know.
So you're there training in Colorado Springs with what would become the 89th Infantry Division, and you're expecting you're going to go overseas in the infantry?
Yeah, because that company was training to go to Italy, but at that time they approved my transfer.
Was that your idea? You wanted to get into the Army Air Corps?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, I just want to fly, I guess.
Had you ever flown before?
I've never flown before.
You'd never been in an airplane. No. But you said, I don't want this stuff on the ground. I want to be up in the air somewhere.
Yeah, so they sent me to Alamogordo to join the 466 bomb group, you know. We boarded the troop train to New York for 5 days. We boarded a Queen Mary across the Atlantic for about 5 or 6 days, you know. That was a rough deal.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No. Never.
And I bet there were a lot more people on that ship than there were in Velarde, New Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
I want to take you back a little bit. When you decided, hey, I want to be in the Air Corps, I want to fly, have you ever, in all the years since, have you ever thought, what if you had stayed in the infantry? Do you think we'd be sitting here having this conversation?
I don't think so, because after the war, kid that came back, he says that company almost killed everybody here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kid that came back after the war, I talked to him, says he was rough, Martin. They almost wiped the whole division in Italy, you know. I was pretty sure that I was going to be killed.
So it's a good thing that you made that switch.
Oh, yeah. Just a lucky person, I guess, you know.
Well, and all your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids
are
probably pretty thankful for that.
Yeah.
And I know I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but so when you went across on the Queen Mary, first time you've ever been on a ship, it's got several times as many people as you grew up with here in Velarde, New Mexico. What was that like? Was that a whole new world for you? And how did you handle the rough seas?
We hit a storm pretty bad.
Yeah?
I got seasick the first day. Pretty bad. But I had oranges and cookies in my backpack. And one day I said, I think I eat the orange. So and I eat pills and all, no. And I take my sister out of my, we hit another big storm. And that boat goes down like this, up, up, the side, all over. It didn't bother me anymore. I woke, and I was woken up one sunny day. They let us go up. I heard somebody say, "Hey, Windy, Windy, Windy." That was Nick, my sister, Jim. I said, "Somebody that knows me." He was a guy from Peñasco. He got killed over there. He was with the infantry division. Because I was the only Spanish that was in the group because I was transferred from infantry to the Air Force.
Right.
Then I met new people, all new people. I didn't know anybody. So I made friends there.
There's a few questions that are coming to my mind here, and I know we're, like I said, we're going all over the place. But one, you ate the orange peel?
The peel's an orange.
And the peel helped you combat seasickness?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
I bet you could start a whole viral sensation on the internet telling people to eat orange peel for seasickness.
Yeah, I had orange in my backpack and cookies before.
Where'd the cookies come from?
From the kitchen, because the kitchen was open 24 hours a day. You can go there and eat T-bone steak, all kind of food, all kind of vegetable, fruit, like a buffet.
I bet it wasn't as good as Alice's tacos at Michael's Mini Mart in Velarde, though.
No.
That would be a pretty tall order, although Mr. Martinez would help in the kitchen a bit once he got to England. 12,000 American troops were crammed onto the Queen Mary, a ship whose peacetime capacity was a little more than 3,200. You might not know that Hitler actually had a huge bounty waiting for any U-boat captain that could sink that very fast-for-its-day ocean liner. Thankfully, that never happened, and Mr. Martinez actually got to climb aboard the ship many decades later in Long Beach with his granddaughter, Mikelin, who ended up with 2 degrees from USC. While many of those infantrymen packed aboard the Queen Mary would end up charging the beaches at Normandy 3 months later, Martin ended up as part of the ground echelon at Attlebridge Airfield in England, where the 466th Bomb Group would complete 232 missions over the next 14 months. And early on there, your job was to make sure those B-24 Liberators were properly armed?
What we do there to get them ready, get all the ammunition. Every machine gun had their own box with ammunition. So we had to get all that ready, put the kind of bomb that they're going to take for some mission. Some bombs have different TNT on it, you know, depends. One of my friends, he was a gunner. And one time, I saw him, Carol Marie, what's his name, from North Carolina. They named him Martinez, you know, like Martinez. Martinez, you want to go up sometime? Yeah, I said, I want to go up. Okay, you go with me today to school. So I went up there and I said, another guy says, "You like to fly? I think you feed on the tail gunner." That was a dangerous place to be on the plane.
So they thought because of your size, you would be good for that?
Oh, yeah. But they go on a mission and they make it home, but most of the wounded guys were the gunners that were wounded more than the other guys.
But that didn't stop Martin Martinez from volunteering to fill in as a gunner on those B-24s, and we're going to hear what those experiences were like when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Mr. Martinez then and now. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing this special Father's Day edition with Martin Martinez of Velarde, New Mexico. This isn't certified by the Guinness Book or anything, but I'm pretty sure we can safely say that he has finished more concrete than anyone in the entire state of New Mexico. 70 years worth all over that part of the country. You'll find an article about that linked at hometownheroesradio.com. He joined the Army right after Pearl Harbor, earned some quick promotions as he trained with the 89th Infantry Division at Fort Carson, Colorado, but then put in for a transfer to the Army Air Corps and ended up heading overseas with the initial force of the 466th Bomb Group, which flew out of Attlebridge Field in England. His assignment was to arm the planes and help out in the kitchen, but before long, he had become a substitute tail gunner on bombing missions. What was it like to be way up there in a B-24?
When you're flying, you carry your mask. There's no oxygen up there, you know. But you could hear the sound of it.
Right.
They fly only 25,000 high altitude, you know.
That's why you needed the oxygen.
Yeah.
And these are not pressurized cabins. You need the oxygen, and it was probably pretty cold up there.
Oh, yeah. In my crew, we had maybe 20 planes in this squadron, and no have names on it. One of the planes that was my favorite plane is the Ghost. The other one was the Sister Baby. And the other one, that Lady Lightning, that's the one that was shut down in Holland. Every plane had their name, you know.
With some pretty entertaining nose art, I'm sure. You mentioned finding out that guys weren't coming back. Was there ever a moment where you thought, I might not be coming back?
Yeah, because they were pretty rough at the beginning. Those Germans were pretty well set up in the ground with the aircraft gun, and they had them all over, you know, so their planes were shot all kind of holes in it. We had to mend them, put some rivets around it and mend it. Some planes were full of holes, and I come pretty close to get killed there, you know. They hit the fuselage on my plane pretty bad, you know.
So you were on the plane.
I was in the plane.
You're flying a mission as a tail gunner. And did you know the guys you were flying with? Had you ever flown with them before?
No. I flied whenever the substitute, you know.
How many times do you think that happened?
I went up 16 times.
That
I know. Guys that make 35 missions, they send them back to the States. Complete their missions.
Right.
A year and a half after I was there, the group make 100 missions. So they figured in 100 missions, they destroyed quite a bit of it over there.
Mm-hmm.
And 100 missions, there's a lot of fire. The group make a big party. They brought the stars from Hollywood. I don't know how they went up there during the war. I don't know how they got there. Mickey Rooney. A lot of stars. They were a bomb once. They celebrate for 2 days. They drink. I don't know how many gallons of English beer.
This was mid-August 1944, and this big party for the 466th Bomb Group having completed 100 missions, and I read Glenn Miller and his band were there to perform.
Yeah, he was there. Mickey Rooney. Oh, a whole bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
I went up there, and was too crowded, you know. They had this big hunger, and they go to town and gather all the girls that can getting all over. There were trucks full of girls that I guess they didn't know about this party. I didn't know about the party.
All the British girls, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They brought girls from town, a bunch of nice-looking girls.
So those were some of the times you wanted to remember, but there were other things that weren't quite so pleasant, like the threat of buzz bombs, these flying bombs launched from the other side of the English Channel, sometimes as many as 100 a day heading toward England.
We can tell when they come in because they make funny noise, you know. You can hear 2-3 miles away, you know. You know the,
but when the noise stops, that's when you get out of the way, right?
Yeah. They hear a nearby big farm where this guy raised those barbed wire horses.
Clydesdales?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They carry a big wheel, like one horse carry a carriage. They raise red beet and sugar beet, and they hit that poor guy and kill all their horses, you know.
Yeah, you think about the buzz bombs in the urban settings and all the damage they did in London, but it...
Yeah.
It hit rural spots, too. When I asked you about, were there some times where you wondered if you were going to come home? You mentioned being in the bomber, in the B-24, and getting shot at.
Yeah.
What are you doing during that time?
Well, you travel maybe 4 hours before you hit the target. You
know? Right.
You're just thinking, when is it going to start, you know? You're not anxious to see them, but you're in the lookout for them.
Looking for fighters, enemy fighters.
Yeah. Once you hit near the target, then what you have to be wary about. But I never got scared, never. Anyway, if I'm going to get killed, I'm going to get killed. There's no way to survive, no way. Because you're in the middle of Germany. When Germany captured all these towns, like Yugoslavia, Belgium, they took all the people out of town. And that's where they built their facilities. Right in every town, they had like tanks. Factory, plane factory, missile factory. In every town, they have projects going that never finish.
So you said you were never scared. Did you have enemy fighters that came at your plane?
Yeah, a few. A few, they come out, no.
And you shot at them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Think you hit anything?
Oh, yeah. I hit a few of them. They come near you, you know. They go up, down. But we had the fighters too that fight with them while we going, no. But still some shot at the plane, no.
So you guys had fighter escorts to protect the bombers. Yeah. But even then, some of the German fighters made their way through that.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to fire your tail gun at them.
That's right.
But they were firing at you, and your plane got shot up a little bit?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was pretty bad.
How close did it come to you?
Gee, I don't know. Bullets are all over.
And fighter planes are one thing, but I imagine the flak was probably more consistent. I bet just about every mission that you went on, you encountered some anti-aircraft fire from the ground.
Yeah, almost, yeah. Unless we bomb where they don't have it.
But when they do have it, this is what I'm curious about, because you're in that plane. You're not in control of the plane. Even the guys who are, they can't dodge anything. They're flying straight ahead in formation.
Yeah.
And you know that flak is coming your way.
Oh, yeah.
So what's going through your mind as you're prepared to fly through this field of flak?
One time I mentioned that if we fly lower than that, we can survive. And you can save a lot of people. I mentioned to my friend, why don't they fly Charlie missions better?
So your thought was fly lower and the range of the anti-aircraft guns wouldn't be set right. And you mentioned a term there that a lot of our listeners probably have never heard before. Trolley missions. Those were low-level missions, and pretty much the whole 8th Air Force flew them in Europe the final week of the war and even after the Nazis had surrendered. The idea was to reduce the normal crew of a bomber and fill the rest of the spots with ground personnel who had been overseas for months and months, even years, and now would get an aerial view of the results of all their hard work. So everybody from cooks and bakers to crew chiefs and mechanics got the chance to fly in bombers and take aerial photographs at low altitude. Unfortunately, there were some planes shot down on some of those trolley missions, including one from Martin Martinez's squadron. He lost a friend that day. And I know you say it wasn't too scary for you, that you were resigned, that what was going to happen was going to happen, but you faced plenty of danger when you flew, and even when you were on the ground in Attlebridge, whether it was arming planes or helping out in the kitchen, you still had to face that ever-present danger of buzz bombs or German bombers coming over at night.
At night, it was all blacked out.
Right.
Blackout. No light. Where I live is a place about this big for 4 guys. The windows was painted with black paint about this thick, no. Best light than the casino light in there. You couldn't even light a cigarette. You couldn't even light nothing. They tell us those guys can see you anything. But
Mm-hmm. When you think back about the time that you spent in the military during World War II, what are you the most proud of?
More proud of it? I'm proud because, oh, I come home and people were waiting for me. I was very proud. The bus driver said when I came, where I live here was about 20 families, and says, Martin is coming home. We saw Martin in Santa Fe this morning. He's coming this way. And then my mom and the people that Martin is coming home and the next bus, and about 50 people waiting for me up there by the highway, hugging and crying. And I wear that suit, you know, real sharp, you know. The first soldier that got home, that was me. Mm-hmm. My brother got home 2 weeks later. See, my brother fought with the 45th Division.
Oh, really?
Up there by going up to North Africa and Sicily. That's where they started.
Yeah.
And four of the people that with him came home. So four of the guys from Hispaniola came. The other guys didn't make it. That was my brother's division. Those guys fought all the time, all the time.
What was your brother's name?
Tom.
Was he older or younger?
Yeah, he was older.
So you come home from this war, you meet your wife, start a family?
Yeah, I started another life, you know. I just forgot about military anymore, you know, that's it. Once you get discharged, you and your room, when you get home, you take the suit off, because that's no good. And you turn it yourself, you're on a civilian life already, you know. Military don't have nothing to do with guys anymore. You start a new life, but I haven't forgot where I was, you know.
One thing that comes to mind for me, knowing that you came back home and you met your wife and you had a family, and now there's kids and grandkids and great-grandkids who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive the war. Have you ever thought about that?
Never thought about it.
When you're gone, what should they remember about World War II and what you and your brother and 16 million other Americans in uniform did?
Well, all I think about all them boys that were staying there, they would have been just about my age. And the poor kids, you know, had to leave home just to get killed. And they never come back. That's what I think, that after they're born in that family here and then they come back, you know, I feel terrible about it, you know, because they miss all this. They missed all this time like me, you know. I really love this part of the world myself. I feel kind of bad about it. Poor guys, and I feel bad for their families también, you know, because they used to come and ask me about them. I said, at the beginning they were with me, but when I left, I have no information for you kids, you know, that got killed over there. They come home and ask me every day, crying, the mother and the brothers, come on, Martin, tell us about it, about my boy. I says, when I separated from them, I wasn't the best training with them, but I don't know nothing about them.
Because they were killed in the infantry.
Yeah.
And you weren't there. Do you think that what you did was important?
I guess so, because when you go there, you got to do your part and not take good care of the other boys, you know.
I just want to say thank you for serving our country.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for telling us your story.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about that was important to you?
No, just that I don't think I'll never get my medal.
Well, we are going to make sure that happens, especially since Mr. Martinez has his DD-214, his separation form that lists the medals he's due. He might even have a few others in store for him that weren't listed on that form from 71 years ago. And maybe there's a parallel to your family right there also. Maybe Father's Day is an excuse to talk to your dad or grandpa about his military service. And if there is some unfinished business, what a blessing you can be by helping him tie up those loose ends. We covered a lot of territory today, and one thing I love about doing this show is that as much as there are parallels between all these veteran stories, that some of them are pretty similar, each one has a unique story and a unique perspective. And the details they add to our understanding always leaves us a little clearer on the big picture of World War II and the bottom line. So many of us wouldn't be here if our dads or granddads hadn't safely made it home. And for all of us, the freedom we have would not exist without the men and women who have risked their lives and way too often given their lives to preserve it. One final Father's Day thought. You've heard a lot about honor flight here, even today with Mel and Carol, who took that journey from Las Vegas. Volunteers are making this happen all over the country, including wherever you're listening today. So especially if you have a dad or grandpa who served in World War II and time is running short, I can't think of a better Father's Day gift than to sign them up for this free, life-changing experience. I have those links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for now, but thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.